We begin this hour with food, specifically vegetables. A lot of money and time goes into making better crops to feed more people. That comes down to the science of developing new types of seeds. Because of all the resources that go into them, varieties of seeds are often controlled by patents and licenses. But there's a group of scientists and food activists who want those seeds shared freely. And today they're launching a new campaign to change how seeds are governed. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
Erwin Goldman at the University of Wisconsin in Madison is one of the people behind this campaign.
I breed carrots and onions and table beets, and I teach courses in plant breeding.
He pollinates the plants and selects the most attractive offspring, creating new varieties for gardeners and big farmers alike. When he started doing this more than 20 years ago, he says, there was an explicit code of ethics among plant breeders. You didn't own your work, you shared it.
Other breeders, if they asked for our materials, we would send them a packet of seed. They would do the same for us. That was a really wonderful way to work, and that way of working is no longer with us.
These days, seeds are intellectual property. Some are patented as inventions. You need permission from the patent holder to use them, and you're not supposed to harvest seeds for replanting the next year. Even university breeders do this. When Erwin Goldman creates a great new variety, the university licenses it to seed companies. The money this brings in helps pay for Goldman's work, but he still does not like this system of restricting access to plant genes, what he calls germplasm.
If we don't share germplasm and freely exchange it, then we will probably limit our abilities to improve the crop.
Sociologist Jack Kloppenberg, also at the University of Wisconsin, has been campaigning against seed patents for 30 years for slightly different reasons. He says they've led to the rise of big seed companies that are promoting ever bigger farms.
The problem is concentration and the narrow set of uses to which the technologies and the breeding are being put.
So this morning, Goldman and Kloppenberg and some other seed patent critics will gather on the front lawn of the university's microbial sciences building, and they'll launch what they call the Open Source Seed Initiative. It's inspired by the example of open source software, that software that anyone can use, but you're legally prohibited from turning it into a proprietary product. They're unveiling 29 new varieties of carrots, broccoli, kale, quinoa, and 10 other crops. And they're saying these new varieties are unrestricted, no patents or licenses. In fact, if you use them to breed new lines of vegetables, you have to make those new varieties freely available too.
So what we're talking about is freeing up material again.
Kloppenberg says one important goal for this initiative is simply to get people thinking and talking about how seeds are controlled.
It's to open people's minds. It's a kind of biological meme, you might say. Free seed, seed that can be used by anyone.
Anyone can use them, but most people probably won't be able to find them. The companies that dominate the seed business probably will keep selling their own proprietary varieties or hybrids. There's more money to be made with those seeds. Most commercial vegetable seeds are, in fact, hybrids, which come with a kind of built-in security lock. If you replant seed from a hybrid, you won't get exactly the same kind of plant. John Schoenecker, director of intellectual property for the seed company HM Close in Davis, California, says his company may avoid using open-source seed to breed new varieties.
Because then we would start, you know, investing in it and have limited potential to, recoup the investment.
Because the offspring of open source seeds have to be shared too. Erwin Goldman says he expects many plant breeders at universities to join the open source effort. And two small seed companies that specialize in selling to organic farmers are adding some open source seeds to their catalogs this year. Dan Charles, NPR News.
You probably know the feeling of pins and needles, a numbing, tingling sensation that can be pretty unpleasant, but probably short-lived. Unless you happen to be one of the millions of Americans who suffer from something known as tingling and numbing paresthesia. It's a chronic and fairly common condition in which the uncomfortable prickling feeling doesn't go away and even becomes debilitating. Researchers do not fully understand what causes this constant tingling or how best to treat it, but as Ike Sriskandaraja reports, a possible key to the mystery lies in an unexpected place.
Mission Chinese in San Francisco is a restaurant, not a science lab. But I'm here because of a science researcher. Diana Bautista is at the Department of Molecular and Cell Biology at UC Berkeley and an expert on our sense of touch.
A lot of what we know has come from studying interesting plants that give us unique sensations.
How we experience the heat of a chili pepper, for instance, or the coolness of a mint leaf. So, When Bautista decided to investigate what goes on inside nerve cells when we get a tingling, numbing sensation, she turned to the berries of the prickly ash tree, better known in Chinese cooking as the Sichuan peppercorn. It's famous for the strong, vibrating buzz it makes in your mouth. Jesse Coity, head chef at Mission Chinese, brings a taste.
Okay, so I just wanted to bring these out. These are the three forms of Sichuan peppercorn ingredients that we use.
My friends and volunteer taste testers, Sabrina Ramos, Chris Edley, and Steve Backer, eyeball the three small plates of spice. There are pea-sized red peppercorns, green peppercorns, and an oil super-infused with ground Sichuan peppercorns.
Should I put multiple? The oil is going to be very scary. I'm nervous.
When I visited her lab, Diana Bautista had told me what to expect.
You get sort of a wave of different sensations. First, I experienced a light citrus flavor.
It's very flowery.
And then you start to feel a little bit of a prickling sensation.
Well, it starts to get tingly.
It just hit the tip of my tongue like a burst.
And at its apparent apex,
and then when you think that it's ending, it's actually just about to start.
Wow.
Oh, I feel the buzz.
Oh, yeah. Oh, now I'm really kicking.
Now, what Bautista, who's a neuroscientist, wanted to know was, why do we feel this mouth buzz from eating a bowl of spicy mapo tofu? Is the Sichuan pepper activating the same nerve cells that respond, say, when your cell phone buzzes or you use an electric toothbrush? It's a tricky question, because there are 30 different kinds of nerve cells called somatosensory neurons, and they each respond to different tactile sensations. So how do you figure it out?
You could look in the microscope.
In her lab, I'm staring into a dish full of somatosensory neurons taken from a mouse.
It's a mixed population of cells that includes touch, itch, and pain neurons, all 30 types together.
Bautista says one day she took a mixed bunch of cells like these and exposed them all to an extract called sanchul, the active ingredient that gives Sichuan pepper its buzz. That's how she made the discovery. Most of the cells did nothing, but one type did respond, the big ones.
So the big ones are the ones that are sensitive to light, touch, and vibration?
Sichuan pepper was activating the very same type of cells that let you feel your phone vibrating.
And so we were really excited, and it is the first compound that specifically targets the touch pathway.
But that's not all. Not only does Sichuan pepper chemically mimic touch,
it turns out that Sichuan peppers activate the same neurons that are affected in patients who suffer from tingling and numbing paresthesia.
Which was a real find. For one thing, it finally gives scientists a way to study in the lab all the chemical and electrical steps that lead to the brain getting the message when your foot falls asleep. Researchers can now take touch cells, get them buzzing using the pepper extract, and then start to figure out exactly what's going on at the molecular level, which might suggest ways of switching off the buzzing in patients who live with this tingling, numbing sensation all the time. And researchers have been using Bautista's finding in other ways, too. I came across a paper in the British journal Proceedings of the Royal Academy, wonderfully titled Food Vibrations. Good vibrations. It was written by Nobuhiro Hagura, a neuroscientist at University College London, who wanted to know whether everyone experiences those peppery vibrations in the same way, like we all hear the same note in music.
The bottom line is very simple. We wanted to know, what is the frequency perceived by Sichuan pepper, and is it consistent across participants?
He designed a neat experiment. 28 willing volunteers came to his lab, and instead of giving them some spicy Sichuan takeout, they each got enough sanchul extract to make their mouths tingle. Each of them also got a small box that could vibrate, a bit like a cell phone. You can sort of imagine the scene. The task for the tingling volunteers was to try to match the peppery vibrations in their mouths to the vibrations they could feel in their fingertips as the researchers dialed the frequency of the box up or down.
And they're closing their eyes, and they're saying higher or lower. So it's a kind of a bizarre situation.
Until the Sichuan buzz and the mechanical buzz converged on the same frequency, which turns out to be 50 hertz. That's the sound of how the Sichuan pepper tastes. Scientists are still looking for other plants that could help unlock the secrets of our sensory nerves. And who knows? Maybe there's a whole somatosensory symphony just waiting to be heard. For NPR News, I'm Ike Sriskandaraja.
That UPS guy in the brown shorts delivering your packages? Turns out every minute counts. These days, the company is using technology to push its drivers to be more efficient, which of course increases profits, and that might teach other companies how to do the same. Here's Jacob Goldstein from our Planet Money team on a UPS truck in rural Pennsylvania.
The UPS guy, the brown truck, the barking dog.
I'd advise you not to get out of the truck here.
It all looks the same as it did when Bill Earl started driving for UPS about 20 years ago. But Earl says underneath the surface, his job has changed a lot. That thing you sign your name on when the UPS guy gives you a package, it used to be a piece of paper. Now it's a computer that tells Earl everything he needs to know.
Uh-oh. Beware of the animal.
The computer doesn't just give him advice. It gathers data all day long. Earl's truck is also full of sensors that record to the second when he buckles his seatbelt, when he closes the door behind him, when he starts the truck.
Technology means that no matter what kind of job you have, even if you're alone in a truck on an empty road, your company can now measure everything you do. In Bill Earl's case, those measurements go into a little black box at the back of his truck. At the end of the day, the data gets sent to Paramus, New Jersey, where computers crunch through the data from UPS trucks all around the country.
The data is about as important as the package for us.
This is Jack Levis. He's the guy at UPS in charge of this data. It's his job to think about small amounts of time and large amounts of money.
Just 1 minute per driver per day over the course of a year adds up to $14.5 million.
Levis's team figured out that opening a door with a key was slowing the drivers down. So Bill Earl was given a push-button key fob that attaches to his belt loop.
Is that high-tech or what?
The team figured out how to use sensors in the truck to predict when a part is about to break. And UPS solved a problem that Bill Earl and other drivers used to have. You'd get to the end of the day, and you'd find a package in the back of your truck that you should have delivered hours before.
You want to cry because you have to go back.
Now, a computer figures out the best way to load the truck in the morning and the best way to deliver packages all day. Bill Earl says a typical day for him used to be around 90 deliveries. Now, it's about 120. When you hear people talk about technology increasing workers' productivity, this is what they're talking about. Same guy, same truck, lots more deliveries. And in the long run, as the drivers have gotten more productive, their pay has gone up. UPS drivers today make about twice what they made in the mid-90s, when you include their wages and their health care and their pensions, according to the head of their union. But Earl says there is another side of driving around a truck full of sensors.
You know, it does feel like Big Brother.
Take, for example, backing up.
Back right up to their dock here.
For safety reasons, UPS doesn't like it when their drivers back up too much.
They know exactly how many times you back up and where you're backing up. And they also know the distance. They know how far you're backing and the speed that you're backing at.
And so do they ever say, hey, you're backing up too much? You're backing up too fast?
Every day. Every day they do, yes. You can't let it feel like it's an attack on your own personal, the way you've been doing the job. You can't look at it that way because you'll get so frustrated that you won't even want to do it anymore, you know.
Jack Levis, the UPS data guy, says the data are just a new way to figure out how to do things better and faster. And he says the drivers benefit from that along with the company.
They're the highest paid in the business, which is why my job is to keep them productive so they remain the highest paid in the industry.
Still, issues over the data the company collects have become part of the bargaining process between the driver's union and the company. Under the driver's contract, the company cannot discipline drivers based solely on the data, and it can't collect data without telling them. This kind of back and forth about what kind of data companies can collect and what they can do with it isn't limited to UPS. It's going to start popping up for more and more workers at more and more companies. Jacob Goldstein, NPR News.
The man we'll meet next managed to write an entire cookbook about a single ingredient. Food writer Michael Ruhlman found plenty to say about the, well, take a listen.
You can cook it in its shell or out of its shell. If you cook it in its shell, you can hard boil it, soft boil it. If you take it out of its shell, you can poach it, fry it, deep fry it, bake it. You can blend it and then cook it in other different ways. And then if you want to separate it, you can do different things with the white and with the yolk.
His book is called Egg, and he read from it with our colleague Steve Inskeep.
In the kitchen, the egg is ultimately neither ingredient nor finished dish, but rather a singularity with a thousand ends. Scrambled eggs and angel food cake and ice cream and aioli and popovers and gougères and macaroons and a gin fizz aren't separate entities. They're all part of the egg continuum. They are all one thing. The egg is a lens through which to view the entire craft of cooking. By working our way through the egg, we become powerful cooks. Mm.
The egg is a lens through which to view the entire craft of cooking, which is your craft. Use that lens for us. If we just followed the egg through the kitchen and its uses through the kitchen, what will we learn about your craft?
Well, we learn how to make a creamy custard with both egg white and yolk alone. We'd learn how it enriches. When you bake an egg, you see how the egg works on its own and with other ingredients. So again, when you know all the properties of the egg and all the ways it works, you become a more accomplished, powerful, competent cook.
Okay, and I'm just going through here. There's the potato, onion, and cheese frittata. I guess that's the key to the egg, is what you might add to the egg here and there.
Well, that's the thing. The egg then becomes the unifier of all these ingredients. You make basically a custard, and you pour it over all these other delicious ingredients, which soak them up, and the egg combines them and makes them one, makes them whole.
Here's a picture of a seafood dish, scallops and crabs, seafood roulade. What does the egg do there?
The egg white is used there as a binder to hold everything together and to give it a smooth texture.
You even go into the matter of scrambled eggs and argue that there's a way to do them right and a way to do them wrong, and we very, very often do it wrong, and it's a crime.
It's one of the most overcooked dishes in America. We kill our eggs with heat. In most instances, gentle heat is what the egg loves. And when you cook them very slowly over very gentle heat, the curds form, and as you stir, the rest of the egg sort of warms but doesn't fully cook and becomes sort of a sauce for the curds. So it should be a creamy and delicious and delicate preparation.
Do we overdo it because of fear?
We overdo it because of lack of knowledge, and some people are afraid of their eggs. I've never gotten sick from an egg that I know of.
Meaning people just don't know how to make an egg.
Well, again, we're taught in many ways to fear our food, and I think it does a great disservice to the people who want to cook their own food. So I want people to cook, but how are they going to cook if they're taught to be afraid of an egg?
One other vital question here. How normally do you crack an egg?
Gosh, I watched André Soldre, the wonderful French chef of Lutèce, crack an egg, and it never left me. And he just tapped it gently on a flat surface, and then he gently just pulled the egg apart. And I love the gentleness of the way he handled an egg, and I always think about that when I crack an egg.
So that short-order cook thing of whacking the egg on the edge of the pot and throwing it in, that might look impressive, but that's not the way to handle an egg.
It's not the best way, but sometimes it's what's called for.
Michael Ruhlman, thanks very much.
Pleasure to be here, Steve. Thanks.
He is the author of Egg, A Culinary Exploration of the World's Most Versatile Ingredient.